Let's continue in worship by turning our attention to this sacred story that we're handed down for generations. This story that the Hebrew people preserved even though the main character of the story was an enemy to the Israelites, a Moabite. And it's very interesting to discover that this person who is so despised by the people of Israel is actually the one that most has the heart of God in the story before us. You noticed, if you followed along as I was reading, this is a tragic tale. I mean, it is a tale full of what our ancestors called bitter providence. Providence is that word that speaks of how we parallel God's sovereignty and our circumstances, how we understand God's leading and God's ways in our lives, even when there's a bit of a mystery to it, what God's doing. And as far as Naomi's concerned, the providence that she's received is a bitter providence. You notice at the end of verse 13, she says that the hand of Yahweh is against me. So in the midst of all this tragedy, her heart has been depleted. She has come to the end of her rope. Her name, which means pleasant or happy, Naomi, is a name that she then says, I am bitter because of the bitter providence. And she doesn't see God's hand in any way in her life. The Lord's hand is against her. And yet I would like to suggest to you that if we look very carefully for the presence of God in this story, we'll find it. But we find it in the most unlikely of places, in a place that the Israelite people would have a very hard time seeing God's faithfulness and God's presence. And that's in the person, the tenacity, the faithfulness of this Moabite woman named Ruth. Well, let's begin by noticing in paragraph 1 the bitter providence that Naomi experiences. She's experiencing, before the bitter providence, the loss of her husband and of her sons, a situation in her hometown, which is Bethlehem in Judah, the place from which the king of Israel would come, King David, in a few more generations. She discovers there a very difficult situation, a desperate time that calls for desperate measures. So as the story opens, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, and Naomi and her two sons are fleeing to Moab, and they're fleeing there because of a couple of bad providences in the days when the judges ruled. On Wednesday nights, we went through the whole Bible, and some may recall when we went through Judges, what you find, Judges is a mess. It is full of rogues and rapscallions, of people that are leading in places and leading very poorly and in unjust ways, primarily because there's no united kingdom. The people of Israel have divided the land, the promised land, into 12 tribes, and because there's no king, as the book of Judges repeats 4 times, because there's no king, everyone does what was right in their own eyes. So there's no unity, there's no connection to one another, and there's chaos and political instability and confusion. And in the midst of that unstable time, there's a natural disaster. In the day when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land of Bethlehem. Bethlehem in Hebrew means home of bread. It is a place that's very fertile, but all of a sudden there's a famine and it's so bad, the land of bread or the home of bread is now barren with famine, so that Elimelech makes a desperate decision. And that decision is to go to the home of his enemy. To move to a place where, if we were the original readers of this story, we were hearing it for the first time, when we read in verse 1, they went to live, they go from Bethlehem in Judah to the country of Moab, we all go, oh, how disgusting. I mean, how could they do that? Because the people of Moab had no good connection to Israel. Israel had written them off long ago. Their origin goes all the way back to the time when Lot was told to escape the land of Sodom, and Lot refuses to. You remember Lot's wife who turns into a pillar of salt, and Lot just won't do what he's supposed to do. He doesn't go where he's supposed to go, and so he ends up in a cave with his two daughters, and this is how the Bible is. In the cave with his two daughters, he has incestuous relationships with both daughters. One gives birth to the people of the Moabites, the other to the Ammonites. So born out of this disobedience and this incestuous relationship are the people that Israel comes to despise. But not just because of their origins, but because of the times when Israel was moving into the promised land and the Moabites would enter into conflict with them. There was hostility, there was warfare. And even after Israel had settled in the promised land, the Moabites remained enemies and there was constant battle and conflict between the two. So they were at odds. They were enemies. And yet Elimelech realizes desperate times call for desperate measures, and he decides to take his family, instead of starving to death in Bethlehem, to the land of Moab, hoping for a better providence. Well, I imagine that Naomi must have questioned that decision after the death of her husband and two sons. I'd imagine that one of the things she must have wrestled with after the bitter providences occurred was, should we have moved here in the first place? Should we have come here? Would I still have a husband and my two sons if we decided not to come here? Because their whole plan is to escape death. They're trying to keep themselves alive, and yet everyone dies, except for Naomi. And then she's stuck with two Moabites as daughter-in-laws. So I'd imagine that she's like us. She might have thought, you know, I came to a fork in the road, and we chose this fork, and it seems like God didn't follow us here. Seems like we went down this fork and God's abandoned me. The hand of the Lord is against me. So if I had taken this fork, perhaps the hand of God might have been with me. And she does what we often do. We, in our confusion or in our disappointment, say, well, if I'd gone that way, maybe it'd be better. And maybe it would. Who knows? But questioning whether God's presence is with you on any of those forks is like the bunny story we've just heard. Mother Bunny will follow down any of those roads. It's not like anyone stops the pursuit of the Mother Bunny, who is just a pale reflection of the faithfulness of God. So that Naomi is in a bitter providence, but God is still with her, but God is with her in a way that she can't fathom quite yet. Well, as the story proceeds, she loses her husband, she loses her sons. You look at verse 5, it's just a tragic verse. After her husband dies, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. I can't imagine losing my spouse. I can't imagine losing my spouse and my children. And not just my children, all my children. I can't even fathom it. The just disappointment and the frustration and the tears and the grief and the sorrow that she must have felt. But take all of that and add to it the challenges of her culture. Because in her culture, without husband, without sons, she has no security in the ancient world. She's on her own. In a patriarchal society, they are her support and security. Not only that, since there are no sons, there are no heirs. No one carries on the family name. The family name will die with her. And worst of all, she's in a foreign land. So that she's not only facing this bitter providence, she's facing it away from home. So she's alone and abandoned and helpless, and there seems to be no future. And I'd imagine she grieves for years until finally she hears something. Verse 6, she hears that back at home in the land of Bethlehem, there's food again. That the famine's over and she can return home. So in verse 7, she set out from the place where she'd been living. That's Moab. She and her two daughters-in-law, and they went on their way to go back to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back. And what's interesting is Naomi could be doing one of two things, and commentators are divided, and I'd imagine both of these could potentially be true. She's going back. Her daughters-in-law have been good to her. She wishes them kindness, but she knows there's nothing that she can offer them. There's no reason for them to follow her back. She has no security. She has no support. She's just going back home, but she has nothing to offer these two widowed daughter-in-laws. And so she tells them, go away. The Lord's dealt unkindly with me. I have nothing to offer you. Go back to your own home. Or, and I think this is more likely, she's embarrassed and ashamed to be going back home with two Moabite women. Now, they may have been good to her in the land of Moab, where she didn't have the pressure of fellow Israelites that despised and were antagonistic toward them, but it would be awful weird to go back with these two women, and not just women, widows, in that culture, and have them as, you know, your compatriots, your friends. And so, whether she is really wishing them their best and trying to push them away, or whether she's a bit embarrassed and wants to get them away, she does all she can to get them to leave, but they won't leave. They won't leave her side even though they weep. So in verse 10, she tries to persuade them. They say to her, no, we're going with you to your people. And then Naomi turns on the persuasion. She three times hits them with arguments that they cannot in any way get past. She says, you know, I'm old and I can't have any more sons and you're of marriageable age and I have nothing to offer you. And then she plays her final trump card at the end of verse 13, which I've already drawn your attention to, when she says to them, the hand of God has turned against me. I have nothing to offer you. And I don't even have God's presence to give you any sense that what you're doing is of value or the right way to go. There's nothing I can offer you. And in doing that, Orpah finally gets the message. Now, Orpah is never condemned. And by the way, just a note, this is where Oprah's name comes from. Her mother misspelled it, and it's Oprah, and it comes from this story. But it's really Orpah. And I think Oprah is better than Orpah, so I think Mom actually improved the name. Verse 14, they wept aloud, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law. So they don't want to leave, and Orpah's never condemned for leaving. Some people make too much of that. But what she does is she gives us a way to see that there's a contrast. Because Ruth, and at the end of verse 14, you see the key word, Ruth clung to her like Velcro. She just will not let go. She holds on tight and she won't let go. So that Naomi in verse 15 has to say, look, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and to her gods. You go back with her. It's very interesting in that final paragraph. Naomi's essentially doing what you've seen in many movies over and over, where you have some kind of pet that's loyal. Because these two women seem to be very loyal, and the pet's so loyal, but the main character knows that whatever's coming in the future is so dangerous, they want that pet to scram, to get lost, to not have to go through this turmoil. And so all of a sudden, they kind of invent this, get lost, scram, I never loved you, you're worthless, go away, go home. And it seems like Naomi is doing her best to get these women to leave. One will do it. One is finally convinced. Ruth is not. She clings. And Orpah says, please, you have to leave. And that leads us to the final paragraph on the backside of your handout, which is the heart of this story. But Ruth said, don't force me. Don't force me to abandon you. Don't press me to leave you or turn me away from following you because, and these are beautiful words, where you go, I will go. Where you stay or lodge, I will stay. Your people will be my people. Your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There I will be buried. May the Lord do thus and so to me, if even death parts me from you. What's wonderful about this statement is there's no boundaries. Where you go, I'll go. There's flexibility. Wherever you go, there I'm going to go. There is complete eternality to this. This faithfulness is so extreme. Where you die, I'll die. And then at the end, we don't get this too much in our culture. May the Lord do to me if death parts us. That's a way of entering into covenant. That's a way of saying, may the Lord do so to me if I refuse to remain faithful to the words I've just said. She's entering into a deep and lasting covenant, saying, what I've said is so true, I will remain steadfast to this commitment until my death, and if I don't, may the Lord strike me. So it's the language of covenant. And what we start to realize is Ruth is making this deep commitment when Naomi has nothing to offer her. Ruth is making this commitment over and above what would ever be expected because there's nothing that legally binds her to Naomi. In fact, her better options are to leave Naomi. There's no reason that Ruth could ever use to justify clinging to Naomi. Her words and actions are defined not by logic, but by love. And she refuses to abandon the weakest person that she knows, because Naomi really is the weakest. Naomi is going through this hard time. Naomi has nothing to offer her. And yet, as we read in verse 14, Ruth does what the scriptures call us to do in our deepest relationships, both with one another and with God. She clings. The Hebrew word used for cling is the one that's found in Genesis 2, the opening chapters of the sacred scriptures, where we read a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves or clings or holds fast to his wife. And it's such a deep clinging, such a deep Velcro that they become one. They're inseparable. That, however, is always meant to be just a picture of what our relationship with God is to be. Because again and again in the Scriptures, that same word is used of our connection to Yahweh. Love the Lord your God, Joshua 22 says. Hold fast or cling or cleave to God so that you might serve God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. What happens in this clinging and cleaving is the two become one. They become inseparable. And what's really fascinating about Ruth and Naomi and their clinging as they enter into this covenant, they form a very non-traditional family. We talk about the biblical view of the family. Here's a family, a widowed Israelite and a widowed daughter-in-law who have clived together in a way that they've created a new type of family that is committed to one another, embraced one another in a commitment that is almost like a marriage, in a commitment that reflects the heart of God to us and the call of us toward God. However, it's Ruth committing to Naomi, not Naomi committing to Ruth. It's Ruth showing in the midst of this bitter providence, I'm willing to stick with you even if you, like the little bunny, want to run away. So wherever you go, I'm going to go. And what's really interesting about this story, particularly when you realize it happens during the time of the judges, it's parallel during that time. During the time of the judges, the people of Israel are faithless, disobedient. They're rogues, they're rapscallions, they have no fidelity. They constantly prove that and they're judged for it and they experience hardship because of it. But here's this Moabite, an enemy of Israel, someone who's considered an outsider, that has more fidelity and love and commitment than anyone in the book of Judges. Here's this one that we find is going to actually carry on the promise of God, because Ruth will end up being the great-grandmother of King David because of her commitment to Naomi. That's how the story carries on. This story actually is a precedent to a story Jesus will tell. Jesus has a story which we have a hard time hearing now, because when we talk about a good Samaritan, we assume a Samaritan's a good person. But in Jesus' day, to the audience he was speaking, a Samaritan was despised. They were ungodly. They were unholy. They were wicked. They did not keep the law. They were people who were half-breeds. They were people who didn't deserve any honor or dignity whatsoever. And Jesus tells a story about a priest and a Levite and how they don't do what God wants. They don't have the heart of God, but they should. And then he talks about a Samaritan, a despised person in that culture. He says, they're the righteous one. Here's the person showing fidelity, faithfulness, God's love. Well, I believe Jesus gets that story because he's just simply put into a parable the story of Ruth. That we have Ruth here who is the good Moabitess. She's the one in the story that when we ask, in this tragic tale of bitter providence, where's God? As far as Naomi's concerned, God's gone. The hand of the Lord is against her. But in this story, we find no, God is here, but God is found in the faithfulness of a Moabite widow who has that chesed, that covenant loyalty of God, revealed in Ruth's vow to cling to Naomi, to never depart, to never leave, to enter into this unbreakable commitment of love, even when Naomi has nothing to offer her. There's no advantage of staying with Naomi. It is a complete act of sheer love. We live in a culture that doesn't really get that. It's not like that's unique to us. This has been throughout human history. We are not people known for deep and abiding fidelity, particularly when there's nothing in it for us. We are more like, you know, and I hate to use this so close to the Russian tragedy, but it's just meant to be a metaphor. We are the kind of people that if the plane's going down and we know it's going to hit ground and explode, which is what's happened to Naomi. Her life has just gone in all the wrong ways. That we tend to think, well, let's best don a parachute and get out while the getting's good. Let's save ourselves. I mean, the plane's going down, but Ruth's the kind of person who's decided, yeah, the plane's going down and it really is going down, but I'm going to go down with the ship. I'm going to stick with Naomi. I'm going to show her faithfulness no matter what. And in doing that, she reminds me of this wonderful quote, and we're just about done, that comes from Martin Copenhaver, he's a UCC minister, and his writings are very, very good. And he writes about this particular tale: "Our fidelity to those we are stuck with is a powerful reminder of the fidelity of a God who is stuck with us. That is why the story of Ruth, a Gentile, has an honored place in the Hebrew Scriptures. She reminded the Jews of something important about their God. God does not leave when the going gets tough, when we are as destitute as an ancient Near Eastern widow. God is not committed to us because it's in God's interest or for any other good reason. Rather, God is committed to us because that's just the way God is." Now, what's wonderful about our story, if you know the rest of Naomi, the rest of Ruth, they go back to Bethlehem. They go back as people on the lowest place on the totem pole. They have no money, they have no place, so they have to beg and they have to go and glean from the field, other people's fields. That's one of the way they dealt with poverty, that you could go and glean whatever gleanings were left. You weren't to harvest all of your crops, you were to leave some for the poor and impoverished, and they could go and glean it. And Ruth and Naomi are doing that, and it's in the midst of doing that that Ruth recognizes that Boaz is a kinsman redeemer, that he is one that is able to, if he so chooses, marry Ruth and thus perpetuate Naomi's line. Allow Naomi to have a son and to have an heir and for things to go on. And so Ruth, if you know the story, is so bold and so wonderful in her faith. And she goes to Boaz and she eventually wins him over. He marries her. And then at the end of the day, the judges in all their turmoil do nothing to fulfill God's promise. But Ruth, through her faithfulness and commitment to Naomi and Naomi's willingness to take her with her to Bethlehem, leads to the fulfillment of the promise of the birth of King David, because Ruth becomes David's great-grandmother, the great king of Israel, and David then becomes that one also who's in the lineage that leads us to King Jesus. So had it not been for Ruth's "where you go, I go, where you stay, I'll stay," there perhaps would be no King David, and there would perhaps be no King Jesus. And we begin to see that even in the midst of this bitter providence, God's promise cannot be thwarted, for God's presence is there in tenacious fidelity, even when things have gone all sideways and wrong. And God brings things to a divine fulfillment, showing the mystery of providence, how God works through the good and the bad to bring about God's promised end. Perhaps there's someone in your life that's like a Ruth. If so, you are extraordinarily blessed. You have a gift that is hard to even fathom. Perhaps you might think of how you can be like a Ruth in someone's life, because Ruth in this story is as close to a Christ figure as we're going to find. Ruth is like the mother bunny that we saw in the children's story, and the mother bunny is more like God than any character I could imagine in any children's story. Doesn't matter what fork in the road you take, I'm going. You're not going to get away, because in the end you need to come to grips with the fact that you're my bunny. And you need to be with me, for I'm going to be with you wherever you go. May God bless us as we seek to live this out in our own lives. Worship.